like better than starting out by correcting Steve. But let me embrace what he said, first of all, by saying we communicated poorly when we released our recommendation. We have changed the wording of the recommendation. It's still a C recommendation. That wording that you saw is recommends against routine as part of the C language template. Given that it did not fully put forward the intention we had, if you go to the website now and you look up the annals, we've changed that recommendation. It's still a C. But instead of leading with that language against routine, it says the decision to start regular biennial screening with mammography for women age 40 to 49 should be an individual one and take into account patient context, including a woman's values regarding benefits and harms. So I'm trying to recommunicate. I have no relationships to disclose. I want to talk about our process description briefly so that I can cover three interesting issues: number needed to vit versus number needed to screen, estimation of net benefit, and the use of modeling. I'll put in a shameless plug for the mathematics that are behind and statistics behind the recommendation that will be at, I think, 4:30 tomorrow with another group. The task force is an independent panel of volunteers, so we always rail a little bit, called a federal death panel. But we're really volunteer scientists, men and women really dedicated towards trying to get the right answer, charged by Congress to review evidence and make recommendations. This is the steps in our process, and I know they're lengthy, and I'm gonna go through them really quickly to just point out a couple of issues. Once we have the quality of individual studies, we look at the evidence across a set of key questions in an analytic framework, and then we synthesize the evidence across all the questions and judge the certainty of net benefit. So what I want to point out is the number of times the word judge is used. And I usually say that things aren't inherently evidence-based. You don't just look at it and say, oh, that's evidence-based. You have to apply some criteria and you have to make some judgments. And all along the way, there are judgments that are made that involve kind of an interpretation of the data and hopefully the consistent application of the same process. And that's what we try to do. I wanted to show the analytic framework for the screening of any disease. This is the task force that, and framework that generates the key questions. And the key question number one is the one that we really like. It's the overarching question where we can show that screening actually reduces morbidity and mortality. The task force always says that if that's all we had, we'd have a very short portfolio because there are very few randomized controlled trials of screening interventions. And so we've developed this chain of evidence that allows us to look at the evidence for early detection, improvement or intermediate or important health outcomes and the harms in a systematic way so that we can make judgment in those areas where we don't have a randomized controlled trial. That key question one, though, says, does provision of the service improve health outcome and implemented in a general primary care population? And the best evidence would be a large RCT in a representative asymptomatic population comparing outcomes for invited to screen and not invited to screen. And so this is one of the questions that some of the opponents of the 2009 recommendation took on, saying that, you know, that's kind of a conservative approach. And it's true that for an effective screening test, you have to start there, the number needed to screen estimate will be a lower number than the number needed to invite. So it means the number needed to screen to save one life will be a lower number than the number needed to invite in order to save one life. So why do we use NNI? Well, it gives the best unbiased estimate of effect size for a screening test. So in other words, it eliminates sources of bias that we know could or would creep in if we do number needed to screen. What are those biases? Well, there's selection bias, and the concern is those who choose to comply with the invitation could be important from those who don't in important ways. There's a healthy participant bias, there's issue of socioeconomic status and cultural differences that could actually be part of the effect that you see. Also, lead time and length time bias are problematic in using number needed to screen. And length time bias is particularly a problem if there's overdiagnosis, that is breast cancers or any cancers that would never progress. and never affect a woman's life, and in fact, never would be known about had we not done the screening. So those are the kind of sources of bias. Why should we be so firm with screening? Well, remember, screening occurs in asymptomatic, otherwise well persons, and it's hard to improve on asymptomatic. God, that's what we want to be. And I would suggest that before we reach out and drag people into the healthcare system and start doing something to them, we need a high evidence bar. And that's why the number needed to invite is the number we use. Now, I would point out that when we actually looked at the analysis, and Heidi Nelson did this as well as Jeannie Mandelblatt and the rest of CISNET, they did number needed to screen, and the differences really weren't very different. And I think that's important to point out. We wouldn't have come up with a different letter grade. There's two reasons. The participation in screening is very high in the randomized controlled trials, and thank goodness the prevalence, while important, is relatively low in women under 50. This is the analysis that Nelson did, and you see pretty easily that the curves with different mortality reductions really don't start to separate until the 50 to 59 year age group. They're really very similar for 40 to 49. Again, low prevalence of disease is driving that. So when someone says, well, what about the Swedish observational study that found a 25% mortality reduction? And I said, I'm glad it did, but doesn't have a huge impact on the overall analysis. What about estimation of net benefit? This is weighing the balance of benefits and harms. And the problem is we're often looking at disparate outcomes. Benefits are often measured as lives extended or illness events averted, while the harms could be measured as basically the health consequences of false positive screening tests, or the adverse effects of treatment, or sometime adverse effects of the test itself. And so the metric or the currency of benefits and harms often isn't the same, and we're trying to judge net benefit. There are other approaches to estimating net benefit. You could compare number needed to screen and number needed to harm, and that really highlights the disparate outcomes. You could do decision analysis or cost-effectiveness analysis. The task force does not use cost in any of its analyses, so we're not going to do cost-effectiveness. And then there are problems with transparency and the assumptions that can have significant uncertainty around them. So the last thing that we actually do use is outcome tables. They do estimate benefits and harms for a hypothetical screened and unscreened population. They also rely on assumptions with uncertainty, but I think it's easier in an outcomes table to actually describe the uncertainty and do sensitivity analysis in a way that's more transparent to most individuals. Now, we don't have a single number needed to treat, number needed to screen, or number needed to harm that we consider as a threshold because we can't agree on one. I will tell you that at a number needed to screen of 1904, that would be the highest number needed to screen of any test we recommend on a population basis. Even 1300, which is the number needed to invite for screening to save one life for women 50 to 59, is the highest number needed to screen that we have. These are high numbers. Regardless of the evidence, though, we have to use judgment and determine the final estimates of net benefit. So we're trying to weigh benefits against harms. Here's the benefits table, the pooled relative risk from no fewer than 8 randomized controlled trials. An embarrassment of randomized controlled trials is a 15% mortality reduction, which translates to a number needed to invite of 1904. The harms, this is from the BCSC, says per screening round per 1,000 individual screens, so every time I do a screening round in this age group, I generate 98 false positives, 84 additional images, and 9.3 biopsies. Here's the detection rate, that's what I pick up. That's the DCIS. So these are kind of the harms. And you recognize it's relatively high. And so if I do 10 screenings between 40 and 49, I'm generating almost 1,000 false positives in 1,000 women. So the last point, research seldom addresses clinical issues like at what age should we start screening, which is almost always driven by incidence, can be also affected by age-dependent screening utility. So we know mammography gets older as the glandular elements are replaced with fat as a woman naturally ages, so the test actually gets better. We don't always know what age should screening cease. And it's often an issue of age-dependent competing mortality, so that as I get older, I'm just as likely to die of something else before I have my life saved from screening for some disease. We almost never see at what interval should we screen. Often the intervals are given to us, and probably the best screening RCT actually had an interval of 34 months, because that's the quickest they could get people around to the different settings. And should screening vary by subgroup? So what about communities of color? What about special populations where we know there's difference in both disease and disease incidence? And what do we do about screening in those groups when we don't actually have data? So that's where modeling comes in. Modeling extrapolates from the available data to the areas where there are evidence gaps, can provide additional information to guideline groups, and assist clinicians in tailoring care to patients based on individual characteristics. And I'd say it's especially important where benefits and harms are closely matched, which is the definition of the C recommendation. Here's the screening results from the CISNET project brought into real terms. The base case in a cohort of 1,000 women alive at age 40, 30 will die of breast cancer in the absence of mammography screening. And so I want that 3% number to sink in. That's the 3% proportional mortality associated with breast cancer in women alive at age 40. That's the most you have to work with. So the most, if you eliminated all breast cancer deaths, you would change that 3%. Can't get better than that. Where's the 1 in 8 come from? Heavily nuanced number, 1 in 8 women living to age 90 will get breast cancer sometime during her life. That's the whole phrase. That's why 3% and 1 in 8 is different. If you screen women 50 to 74 every other year, we would reduce that 30 by 7 to 23 deaths. Now, the 23 women, the 7 women still die, they just die of something other than breast cancer. That's the way the life table analyses work. If we expand screening to age 40, we may reduce that number from 7 to 8. So we pick up an additional life. And if we screen annually, we may also reduce that number from 7 to 8. Now, these are optimistic assumptions, 100% compliance. Test works as well as it always works or ever works. And women complete all treatment. The harms of expanding to age 40, mammograms increase from 9,000 to about 14,000, false positives from 780 to 1,250, unnecessary biopsies increase from 55 to 84. If we look at annual versus biennial, the mammograms, false positive, and unnecessary biopsies nearly double. So if you think about the currency of screening, this is the cost for that one additional life. And recognize that these women get no health benefit, right? They just get the harms. You can't even say peace of mind because, about 5,000 women get additional false positive results. That is not reassuring. So not saying right or wrong, this is just the currency for the benefit versus the harms. Incremental benefits starting at age 40 is small. Harms aren't life-threatening, but they're very common and go up really quickly. If you start at age 40, net benefit is small. And that takes us to our grid, which says this is certainty of net benefit, kind of our risk of being wrong, high, moderate, or low. Magnitude of net benefit, benefit minus harms. We end up with a moderate certainty of a small net benefit, which is a C recommendation. Here's the templated language against routine use. That's the language that both Dr. Petiti and I have owned, did not fully convey what we really meant to say, and we own that. And thinking about how to move communication forward, I think, is going to be the next things we talk about. But I hope I've given you three kind of areas where additional education and thinking could help. One is number needed to invite versus number needed to screen and why that gives a better unbiased estimate. Number two is how do we balance disparate harms and outcomes And number three, what's the role of modeling in trying to fill in the gaps so that the task force just doesn't say, we don't know when to start, we don't know when to stop, we don't know how often to do it, but we think it works? Thanks.